You're listening to KTNA 88.9 FM Talkeetna. My name is Philip Manning, and you're listening to Sioux Valley Voice, KTNA's local public affairs program. The following is our rebroadcast of Wednesday morning's show. Sioux Valley Voice airs live every other Wednesday at 10 a.m. My guest today was Alaska State Senator Mike Dunleavy. We discussed the 2014 legislative session, energy, education, and a number of other topics. After introductions, I began by asking Senator Dunleavy, a former school teacher, to assign a letter grade to this year's legislative session.
You know, that's difficult, right? Giving a session a letter grade. I mean, giving a lot of things a letter grade is difficult because it's very very subjective. you know, I have concerns about the size of the budget. I do think, though, we're on the verge of getting some things into place that are going to be able to contain the growth of the budget. In terms of advancing a gas pipeline, I think things went well there. We certainly worked on education. I know that's going to be a topic of discussion here today, and it should be. And, it was termed the education year by the governor, but really, I mean, every year should be looked at as an education year because education impacts everyone. In terms of the session, there was a lot of hard work done. It was very busy. You know, it's difficult for me to give it a grade. There's some things that I think, went well, and some things that weren't advanced. So,
okay.
I don't know. B?
B. Well, you're an education guy, so I thought maybe. I guess then to bring it to more specific terms then, I mean, what would you say was the biggest achievement? Is it the gas line?
I would say from a historical perspective and for a statewide perspective, it would be the gas pipeline.
Okay.
We also, you know, we dealt with a long-standing, festering and growing debt in our PERS retirement. We put a total of $3 billion into both of those retirement systems in the hopes of paying down that debt and infusing more cash into the retirement system so they're able to remain solvent. You know, and I'll just another note on that. Those retirement systems, technically speaking, were never really in jeopardy of any type of default because we have enough cash in reserves. We have enough reserves to cover the obligations. But the payments over time would have escalated a little bit. And this infusion of cash, once again, the retirement board can invest this cash, get a return, and I think we're going to be able to get things on a pretty good footing here going into the future.
And PERS and TERS, that's the retirement plan for state employees and teachers, respectively.
Yes, right.
So, I mean, I guess, and the theory that was put forward both by the governor and by the legislature, which obviously supported it, is that it'd be akin to paying down the principal on a car loan or a mortgage or something like that in the interest of decreased future payments.
Right.
I'm not a math guy, so but that's the impression I got. I have a feeling I might know the answer to this one already, but what's your biggest disappointment of the session as far as what didn't happen that you would have liked to see?
You know, obviously, SGR 9 and its companion resolution in the House, it was disappointing from the perspective that...
And that's how SGR 9 is the constitutional amendment for that would allow public funds to private schools.
Yes. And it did advance because in the end we didn't have the votes. You know, it's not a simple majority when it comes to putting a constitutional amendment on a referendum. And you know, the I guess the, once again the disappointing thing is it wasn't able to get to the people for them to weigh in. But I certainly think the conversation advanced the whole concept of education, what education should look like going into the future. And I think that conversation is going to continue. I would say, but interestingly enough, I'd say one of the other areas or one of the other bills that was advanced, but I'm not sure if it's been signed yet by the governor, to be honest with you, was a bill by Fred Dyson. And what that bill did is, I'm not sure if how many folks are familiar with with CourtView. And what CourtView is, it's a state-run website that has all of the court cases on there. And the problem with what was happening with CourtView was, let's say, Philip, you were accused of a crime. That would go on CourtView, and that remains on CourtView basically forever, even if you were not convicted, if you were innocent. I mean, and these things range from simple traffic violations, civil courts, any type of court action. you will be on court view. For example, I had a blinker out that I was not aware of. I was pulled over. And, you know, the officer, very professional, did his job. I got the blinker fixed. But unbeknownst to me, you know, folks later on the road, this is years ago, later on the road said, you know, you're on court view. I said, what's that? So I went to court view and I could see that I was there. But for a lot of folks, court view has become a way to judge an individual's character. And again, the most important thing to keep in mind here with court view is you don't necessarily, you're not necessarily convicted of a crime. Hmm. You're not necessarily even did a crime per se. But as long as you've been cited, or it's a civil case, or you've been arrested, you're on court view. And so what Senator Dyson was trying to do is, unless you were convicted, get their history off of court view. And we're one of the few states that do this. Most other states, you're not on a public record for the public to see unless you've been convicted of a crime. So in a way, that was a disappointment because my understanding is the governor has yet to sign that bill.
Okay. And any indication that he will or won't?
I don't know.
Okay. We have had a lot of bill signings kind of trickling out over the past couple of weeks.
Yes.
So.
Yes.
Okay. So, I mean, looking forward to the future then as far as things down the road. And I guess, obviously, we'll talk about education later as well, but the education bill was a big factor in causing Session to run over. Ran over 4 or 5 days, something
several
like that.
Several days, yep. Yeah.
And education was kind of right in the middle of that fray. I mean, obviously, the gas pipeline and negotiations and discussions around that took a long time, too. But really, education was kind of the centerpiece. And I know a lot of folks were disappointed that it ran long. But at the same time, I think everybody obviously agreed that getting the education bill done was not getting it done was not an option.
Right. I'm not, you know, I'm not one of those that wants to get out of Juneau at all costs. In other words, it's pretty important business. And when you're at the end of a session, and keep in mind that a session is a legislative session is 2 years.
Hmm.
So when you introduce bills, for example, in year one, those bills will survive the summer and go into year two. But after year two, those bills are done. And so we had some important work to do. Yes, certainly there were folks that wanted to get out of there, and some really wanted to get out of there. But a number of us were concerned that we wanted to try and do our best to get it as close to being as right as we could, and putting in the time was not an issue for us.
Okay. And then another thing that was kind of confusing about that is there's a constitutional limit of 120 days on session, but a statutory limit of 90 days on session.
Yes.
So where does that – I never really understood the significance of that statutory limit if it can just basically be pushed aside.
Well, you know, that's a very good question. And to be honest with you, that's not something I really looked into because, again, I'm not a clock puncher. I mean, I'm down there for 90 days or 95 days or 100 days or whatever it takes to get the job done. So I'm not – I know it's a constitutional limit, like you said, on 120 days. I know it was a statutory limit that was put in several years ago by the legislature on 90 days. But I'm not sure exactly what ramifications, if any, there are and what triggers or what things have to be done to make sure you can legally go beyond the 90 days.
Okay. I was curious about that, and I had some questions about that. I was like, well, there's a law, but apparently they just run right on past it.
Well, I guess that's one way of looking at it.
So my guest today is Senator Mike Dunleavy, the state senator for the Upper Valley, as well as a number of other areas, more areas now. If you'd like to join in on our conversation, you can call 733-1200, send an email to dj@ktna.org, or I've got a post up on the KTNA Facebook site, and you can leave a comment for us on there as well if you have questions. So I guess now looking forward, you know, this is what we'll be starting a new session in 2015. You're running once again for your seat in what is now Senate seat E.
Correct. Yes.
A lot of reshuffling. I know when I had Representative Keller on a couple of weeks ago, I had nailed down the new number for House District 10, and now we're Senate seat E. Looking forward, if you're still a member of the state Senate in January, what's going to be your biggest priority? Is it bringing back SJR 9? Is it fiscal issues, energy? What's your number one priority when if you're back in Juneau next winter?
Well, I'm a as I mentioned in the beginning here, I'm pretty concerned about the fiscal situation. I believe we're spending too much. And when I say we, I mean all of us. And we have an opportunity to be either part of the problem or part of the solution. And so I think those discussions will take place, need to take place. They began last year. And I guess the best way to look at it is, you know, this budget has been growing for some time. This budget's been growing before I got in there. But when we did get in last year, we were able to slow the growth of this budget down considerably. So, I mean, it's akin to a train going 90 miles an hour. We've got it down to about 5. Well, next year we've got to stop the train, and then we've got to reverse it. There's just a number of things I think we could do once again to cut the budget without impacting directly average Alaskans, without necessarily impacting certainly education and other state functions. And we just need to earnestly dive into it and come up with a budget that's going to be sustainable over the long run.
Okay. And so I guess that kind of encompasses energy, education, all of it. But do you think deficit spending in particular? And I mean, I guess tied to that is the state's revenue stream. And so, I mean, there's some recent predictions as well. And I mean, the revenue outlook is not terribly favorable. So at what point, where do we make the cuts in order to get to that more responsible level of spending you're talking about?
Right. And that's part of the issue. As you know, SB 21, which was passed last session, was an attempt to lengthen the window, lengthen the timeline in which we would be getting revenue from the state. I know that a lot of folks are terming it as a giveaway, and that we are not, right now, we are not maximizing our resources for the benefit of the people. But there's a number of folks that believe that to some extent that was a short-term approach to things, get as much money now as we possibly could, and really not looking at the future. And the hope, again, with 21 is that instead of getting enormous sums of money today, we can lengthen this window in which oil will be a mainstay for our revenue source, but at the same time start to bring gas online. And as you mentioned last night, we had the discussion with LNG, and we started out with that concept a couple years ago as a small in-state gas line to service the needs of folks. For those that were at the discussion last night, what you soon realize is that you're really to maximize gas that we have on the slope and to minimize the cost to Alaskans to get that gas, you have to have as big a pipeline as possible, 42-inch pipeline or even larger, that's going to export gas to drive down the cost. And so working at getting the budget in line, working at maintaining oil as a mainstay for governmental functions, and then bringing gas online, I think is where Alaska's future is going to lie.
Okay. And so, I mean, the timeline we were given last night for the gas pipeline is 10 or 11 years. So in the meantime, I mean, it, for SB 21, which is oil tax reform, which is up for a referendum
right
here in the next couple of months in August.
Right.
I mean, do you see SB 21 then sustaining us through that 10 or 11 years until we get gas online?
Well, that's, again, a very good question, because people have asked me, as soon as SB 20, the interesting thing was, as soon as SB 21 was passed, I mean, as it was passed, within minutes, if not hours, those that opposed it were talking about an initiative to overturn it. And, you know, there were a number of us. I never worked for the oil industry. I've been in education my entire career, so I've been a teacher in Alaska here since the early 80s. And I'm not tied with the oil industry directly. But a number of us said, well, why don't we wait for a year or two to see if SB 21 has the stated impacts that it was supposed to have? But a number of other folks on the other side of the issue are saying, no, absolutely not. We're going to get rid of that right now. And then when you start to have conversations with the folks and you say, well, what's it going to look like then if SB 21 is repealed? What is your plan? What is your tax plan? Well, we're going to revert to ACES. The funny thing about that is, almost every single, I can't think of an individual, at least in the Senate, I don't even think in the House, that believe that ACES in its current form did not need to be reformed, did not need to be changed. The progressivity issue in which as prices goes up, the state takes more and the companies take less. I didn't hear a person say that was a component that they wanted to necessarily keep at that level. So the point I'm trying to make is just about everybody involved in the legislature, those that were involved in the creation of ACES, those that were involved in the creation of SB 21, agreed that ACES needed work. ACES needed to be changed. If that's the case, why not wait for a year or two to see if, in fact, the oil companies are going to invest in Alaska, and that we will have a longer window of oil as a main revenue source. I told folks, and I told the oil company this, I said, if you don't invest in Alaska, if in fact this is a game, if you've pulled the wool over our eyes and you've taken us for fools, you're probably going to end up with a situation where you're going to have ACES on steroids, and you're going to have a number of us, including myself, leading that charge. In other words, I think we need a year or two, 3 years at the most, to determine if, in fact, this new bill, SB 21, is going to have the desired effect. If it doesn't, if it's not going to, if they're not going to invest in Alaska, if they're going to invest in other places of the world, and they're just going to take the money, they're just going to harvest our oil, it's very simple to then go back and change 21 to an oil tax regime that I think the majority of Alaskans would support.
Okay. And so, I mean, as far as that benchmark goes, proving there, it, is that just, you know, dropping more wells on the slope, or?
No, I think for many of us, it's increasing production. See, under ACES, which was interesting, and a lot of folks may not know this, but we were scheduled to give upwards of $900 million back, and this is under ACES, back to the oil companies as capital tax credits. The problem with the ACES tax capital tax credits is, it wasn't tied necessarily to production. Oil companies could take those tax credits, improve a runway, improve a road, buy pickup trucks, put more buildings on the slope, et cetera. But that didn't necessarily have to translate into more production. Under 21, it's going to have to translate into production. And so the benchmark, I think, for all of us is does oil production increase? Will we ever get back to 2 million barrels like we did in 89? I doubt it. Will we ever get back to a million barrels? That's questionable too, but there's a hope that we can maintain what we have and actually increase this over time. And remember, time is both our enemy and our friend, because we start to work at getting the gas pipeline online, but at the same time, if we can work through what's happening on the offshore oil production that was headed by Shell and the Beaufort and Chukchi, if in fact those offshore opportunities come to fruition. Although we may not get the taxes from those particular fields because they are offshore and they are federally governed to a great degree, that oil is going to have to go through our pipeline. And as a result of that, you'll have more infrastructure being stretched over many, many miles of state land that could hold more oil. So time is of the essence. Time is our friend. Time is our enemy. It depends on how you look at it. But I think for 21 and where we're going with the gas pipeline, I'm optimistic, to be honest with you.
Okay. So as far as, and I guess we can go ahead, and energy was also one of the things on my list. So talking about the gas pipeline, obviously, like I said a minute ago, we're 10 or 11 years out at the outside, maybe a little bit longer, maybe a little bit shorter. You know, one of the things at this point that I hear a lot, and I've been to two public meetings on the gas pipeline, and one of the more common phrases I hear is, we don't know that yet. And it's very early on in the process. So, I mean, what is the legislature's role? What is the state's role? Well, AGDC is obviously a part of the state's representative within Alaska LNG. But as far as the legislature goes, or any checks on the big three, ConocoPhillips, BP, and ExxonMobil, where is the legislature's ability to hold them accountable to their commitments on putting this thing together? Because obviously the state is relying on it in the future as a revenue stream.
Right. We have a number of gates or off-ramps, as they say, in the bill that was just passed this last session, in that over the next year or two, 3 years, it'll be determined whether whether we can get the contracts, for example, and gas is a lot different than oil. It's gas is regional. It's not on a worldwide market such as oil. And for us, regional means Asia. In particular, it means Japan and possibly Korea. As some may noted, Russia and China just signed a huge gas deal for mm-hmm. Russian gas. And keep in mind that with Fukushima, when we had the tsunami and then the nuclear meltdown of their plants, they're off of nuclear now. And they are looking for a customer. And we're very optimistic. I mean, this is a timing thing again, that the Japanese and potentially the Koreans will sign long-term contracts, 20-year contracts, 25-year contracts with the producers and with the state of Alaska. It's a different approach this go-around with a pipeline. Before we had oil, we tax oil. The producers produced it. We taxed what they sold, what they made. In the gas scenario, we're actually one of the partners. There's four of us: Conoco, BP, Exxon, and the state of Alaska, as you mentioned, through AGDC. And as a result of that, we're gonna partake in the profits, as opposed to a tax that is similar to what's occurred here with the oil industry. So we're looking at negotiating with Asian countries to make sure that their big electrical companies and other large customers in those countries want our gas, which we believe they do, because these negotiations have been taking place on and off for some time. We're looking forward to signing those contracts or executing contracts here in the next couple years. And the big three producers are going to be part of that, obviously. And then right now we're surveying lines. We're starting to do groundwork for the pipeline coming down from the slope to Livengood. And we're going to take it one step at a time. If the arrangement is not profitable for the state of Alaska, it's not going to work. And if it's not profitable for the producers, it's not going to work. But again, time will tell. The next year we'll be getting more information than the year after that. And then we go what they refer to as pre-FEED and FEED, and then we go into some of the final stages here over the next several years.
Okay, FEED, front-end engineering and design.
Yeah.
Have another follow-up on the pipeline, but before I get to that, my guest today on Sioux Valley Voice is Senator Mike Dunleavy, who represents the Upper Valley in the State Senate. If you want to join in on the conversation, you can call 733-1200 or send an email to dj@ktna.org or visit our Facebook page. On the same topic of the gas pipeline, you mentioned four players, the big three oil producers in the state of Alaska. Now, TransCanada is also in that mix. They're obviously building the pipeline because they're pipeline builders. But as far as that fourth piece with the state of Alaska, how are they involved in that fourth share? Because I know there was some talk with the death of AGEA, which was going to be an exclusive pipeline, now that they're being brought into this partnership. How's that relationship work?
You know, it's it's funny. I was thinking of Facebook where they have on their relationship status, and it says complicated, right? So TransCanada did a lot of field work, a lot of work in understanding. I mean, it's a worldwide, well-known gas pipeline company. And although they don't necessarily build it, they don't necessarily lay down the steel, they understand what's involved in it. And so with the transition out of AGEA into a Tidewater LNG approach to gas, I lost my thought here for a second, but they were brought in to be a partner with us so that our interests are looked after through them and through with AGDC. They are bringing in with them millions upon millions of dollars worth of studies, millions and millions of dollars worth of information, so that we're up to speed and we can have discussions face to face with the big three. Because keep in mind, the big three, their main job is to produce a profit for their shareholders. Mm-hmm. That's their main job. Their main job is not to look out for the state of Alaska. That's our job. And having a company that understands gas worldwide, gas pipeline, gas marketing, et cetera, was deemed to be an advantage to the state of Alaska. So again, if you can look at this partnership is, again, for the state with TransCanada through AGCD, and then the other three quadrants, the other three partners, once again, are Exxon, BP, and ConocoPhillips. So the state has a quarter interest with TransCanada through AGDC, and we're in the process of working out what the arrangements will look like in terms of cut and profit,
okay,
partnership within that small quarter quadrant.
So that quarter of the ownership, then there is going to be some sharing with TransCanada, but the terms on that are still in flux.
Right. I mean, TransCanada, nobody does anything for free.
Sure.
Few companies do, and few people do. So certainly TransCanada has an interest in making a profit as well. And that's the key here. If there is a profit to be made by everyone, including the state, this gas pipeline is a go. And I think most folks are optimistic. But yes, TransCanada would be our partner within that. But certainly they're going to be paid, as we will as well.
Okay. And I mean, they're conceptually, when this was going through the legislature, it seemed like everybody said, yes, let's do a pipeline. The only opposition to SB 138, which is the bill that authorized the current plan, it was from the minority caucus that was saying basically that we're ceding too much control on the project. At least that was my interpretation of what they were saying. And they seemed more in line with, well, let's do this, or let's look at somebody other than TransCanada potentially as kind of an open bid sort of process. And nobody really impugned the abilities of TransCanada, but they were saying basically, let's open the door to see if there's somebody else who's also very good who could potentially do this for us for less. And I guess the decision was ultimately made that wouldn't be the case. But why is that? Why was that not the best plan in
your
eyes?
You know, the Senate as well as the House, through legislative budget and audit, we hire experts that are independent of the oil companies and are independent of TransCanada to give us the best information possible. And these experts, many of them are based out of Texas and some are based overseas, that are experts in both oil and gas. You know, they come and they do research for us, and they are they're our sources for information on this particular topic. And in talking with those folks and going through the presentations that they had for us, it was deemed that TransCanada is a top-notch company, that TransCanada has a long history of producing gas, bringing gas from the ground to market, and involved in various aspects of that train, that they were excellent. And since they were already doing work in Alaska and had some very valuable information in terms of their studies that they've done over the last couple of years, looking first at the pipeline going through Canada, that information, that work, that their position here already and their understanding of our gas situation, in the end, it would be more of a benefit to go with that particular company to help us. So basically, that's what occurred.
Okay.
And again, everything is at this stage is not a done deal. There is still a lot of investigative work that needs to be done, a lot of research, a lot of studies on negotiations for contracts, and this will be taking place over the next couple of years. Again, that's why we have several off ramps that if things aren't working, we can get out. If things aren't working, then this won't go forward, or if things aren't working, it needs to be modified.
Okay. And I mean, obviously, it is very preliminary. We're hearing a lot of if, and we're still working that out.
This is a massive project.
Sure. Right now, the Governor Parnell, at least the administration, he's very much holding this up as part of his reelection campaign, too, that, no, we're really going to get it done this time, because, I mean, as you've alluded to, this isn't the first time we've tried this.
Right.
But there are some differences there as well. We're nearing the halfway point here. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about energy, then move on to education as well as the election coming up this fall. If you'd like to join in on the conversation, you can call 733-1200, send an email to dj@ktna.org, or leave us a comment on our Facebook page. This is Sioux Valley Voice. My guest today is Senator Mike Dunleavy, and we'll be back in just a moment. right, and we're back for the second half of Sioux Valley Voice. My guest today is State Senator Mike Dunleavy. If you want to join in, give us a call, 733-1200, or send us an email, dj@ktna.org. We've been talking for the last 10, 15 minutes or so about the natural gas pipeline. And one thing that came up last night that you and I just talked about during the break is whether or not every individual along the Parks Highway, and even beyond that, you know, out in Bethel, obviously, if this thing runs down the Parks Highway, folks out in Bethel, and they're not going to have a stem line running to their house. So how do we make sure that Alaskans individually receive the benefits of this?
Yes, and that was a huge important component in this bill that was almost overlooked. So, you know, we a lot of folks, their focus is on getting the stranded gas off the slope. Do we do it through Canada? No, we're going to go down and do it to Tidewater. It's going to be an LNG operation. It's going to be somewhere in the neighborhood of $60 billion, the entire process with gas handling facilities and liquefaction facilities and transportation facilities, et cetera. But we got to keep in mind that one of the reasons for doing this was to make sure that we get cheap energy to Alaskans. When I ran for office, that was one of the major concerns for every household I went to. How can we ensure that we get cheap energy for Alaska? Here we are, an energy state, and our residents are paying some of the highest energy costs there are in the country. So as we went through this process, we soon realized that there were mainly discussions in terms of getting gas to Alaskans through basically a process of takeoffs of the pipeline. There's some straddle plant takeoffs so that we could get gas, let's say, for Fairbanks or this community or that community. But what you soon realize is that really very few communities will benefit directly from the gas. In other words, what are the chances of Talkeetna getting a takeoff and having pipes run to their house? I got to be honest with you, it may be slim. And the reason for that is the more takeoffs you have, the more infrastructure you need to put into place to bring gas to an individual's house, the cost goes up dramatically.
Okay. And yesterday, I think one of the things that was mentioned was one of those, it's $250 million. Where did that number came up at one point when we were talking about offtakes?
I think per offtake. And I'm not sure if they were, to be honest with you, I'm not sure. I was in and out of that meeting, and I'm not sure if the conversation was offtake or straddle plant.
Okay.
But regardless, I'll cut to the chase here, and folks here in Talkeetna will really understand this. You know, how many folks here are off the grid? Many.
Fair few.
Right.
Yeah.
And they're off the grid because they're too far away from an electrical line. They're too far away, and they will be too far away from a gas line. So the question was, and I'll wrap this up, the question was, how do we get those people, all Alaskans, whether they're in Kodiak, Southeast Alaska, they're not going to see the gas pipeline directly. Bethel, they're not going to see the gas line directly. So Senator Hoff and myself and Senator Olson out of Nome had the discussion and said, our people are not going to necessarily benefit directly from the gas pipeline. Anchorage will, Fairbanks will, probably parts of the Mat-Su. I live in the Mat-Su. I live down by Wasilla. I'm never going to see gas. I live on 40 acres. To get a gas pipeline from a main to my house, the cost is going to be so exorbitant, I'm not going to be able to afford it. So I'll forever be on, or at least for many, many years, oil. I heat with oil. I heat with wood. I will be on that for some time. So the idea was we set up a fund in which the profit that the state takes in once we export gas goes into that fund. And for those communities that are close enough to a gas pipeline and can get some takeoff points, great. That's where you'd put the money from some of that money from the fund. But for others that live out in the middle of nowhere or live in areas where you'll never see that infrastructure, we are working towards having a fund set up so those individuals can get a royalty of some type to decide how they want to use that check, whether they want to buy oil, whether they want to buy propane, whether they want to buy solar panels or windmill for their house. They'll be able to make that independent decision, but at least they'll be able to partake in the profits of this gas.
Okay. So, I mean, it would almost be a dividend from the gas. Not to confuse the issue, but it would be similar in that respect, ideally.
Yeah. If we're an owner state, the idea is that we are stockholders in the state. And as we were talking during the break, I didn't create the state, and I didn't create the state in that concept. But if we are an owner state and we're going to partake in it, probably the best way to do that is almost through a stock or dividend type of situation where you get a cut out of the gas.
Okay. Speaking of, we do have a caller on the line who has a question or comment about the permanent fund, and that's G. Denny. So, G, go ahead and ask your question.
Hello, Philip, and thank you, Senator Dunleavy, for taking my call. And I think this you took the call at a good time because it just takes off from your current conversation having to do with the maximum benefit to documented Alaskans. If on the continuum from a permanent fund on one end with direct payments to individuals to just the direct funding of government and perceived service on the other, where would you put your funding to private schools? I mean, I see that as kind of a nexus between, you know, if the state just taxes oil or whatever extracted resource and pours it into government, and then government just kind of shares it with itself, and it never really trickles down to any people. How do you see public education and private education? Where does it lie on that continuum?
Yeah, and if I understand your question, I appreciate that very much. You know, before I went to Juno, again, I'm a public sector guy. I'm a teacher. I've been a teacher, a superintendent. I was a school board member and school board president of the Mat-Su School District. So, I mean, education is huge for me. But to answer the question, before I went to Juno, it started many, many years before that. As a school official, I could see that there was waste, that there were opportunities for efficiencies. And when people hear that, they oftentimes mean cutting teachers. And that's the last thing. That's the farthest thing from my mind or what I want to do. And the last thing, I have to emphasize this because I think there was misinformation. I have no desire to privatize education. You mentioned...
Well, you just lost my vote.
No. Well, hang on. No, hang on. Hang on. Hang on. Hang on. Hang on. It's important. What I'm focused on is empowering the individual to make their choices. Empowering the parents to decide where they want to educate their kids. For example, my children right now, the best place for them in discussions with my wife and the kids themselves, I have one at Wasilla High because that is working well for her, and I have another over at the Mat-Su Central School, which is a public homeschool correspondence school. That is working really well for her. If private school was going to work best for our children, we would have them in private school. So my point is empowering the individual. Before I went to Juno, I thought the government was wasteful. I've been to Juno. Government is extremely wasteful. And that's why, for example, as you brought up, you know, the gas pipeline and how we're going to benefit from that, in my opinion, is you give parents, you give individuals the ability, the power, the authority, you give them back what really they had to begin with, their ability to decide where they want to educate their child. If they want to educate their child in a private school, they should have that ability to do that. If they want to educate their child in a public school or a home school, they should be able to do that because we're all very different. We all have very different needs. I don't agree with just a public school system that has a series of neighborhood schools with no other options. I don't believe that's how people operate. I don't believe that's how people, we're all individuals. And so going back to gas, going back to education, I believe giving individuals the ability to make their decisions and how they get their energy, which would be through a shareholder check, if you would, or how they want to educate their child, which could also be through a similar process, I think it's entirely up to the individual. I think my experience is government is extremely wasteful. It's extremely inefficient. And government's more interested in systems and bureaucracies than it is helping individual people. I don't know if I've answered your question.
Well, I thank you very much, and I very much agree with your position.
So I got your vote back.
Yeah, I guess so.
All right. That's
all right.
Good.
Thanks for calling in, G.
All right, bye.
And if you want to join in, you can call 733-1200 or send an email to dj@ktna.org.
Can I just do a quick follow-up?
Absolutely.
That was a very important question. It struck to the heart, I think, of philosophy that I embrace. I've had people say to me, we should totally get rid of public education and just have private education. I've had people say to me, there should be absolutely no private education. I mean, Warren Buffett, for example, is a big fan of absolutely no private education and just public education. the key is really, I don't want to say it's in the middle, but the key is not what system is supported. It's supporting the individuals to make that choice to what system they want to be part of. So the more, in my opinion, the more opportunities, options we have, the better individuals are going to be to make good choices for their kids, their families, and for themselves.
Okay. And well, and so I guess we can go ahead and transition into education. It was one of the things I had to talk about today is, you know, the Mat-Su School District is one that does get talked about as having a lot of options. There's a lot of vocational technical programs. Like you mentioned, the Mat-Su Central School, there's a lot of kids in this area that are part of that as well, as in addition to the more, I guess, traditional, you might say, public schools, the brick-and-mortar type schools. And within that, I mean, a lot of folks would say that we have that choice, that level of choice here in the Mat-Su Borough School District with those public funds. And in a lot of areas up here, there's not necessarily a lot of opportunity for private education in a lot of Alaska because there's just not the population density. So in that sense, I mean, are those parents' choices are limited by geography and by demographics. So at what point would they potentially benefit from something like what you're talking about?
Yeah, very good question. So the Mat-Su is touted in this state as one of the leaders in innovation, and it should be. It should be. And, you know, I'm very, very hesitant. I'm going to cross over the line here for a moment, but I'm very hesitant to, quote, take credit. A lot of politicians, it's all about me, I. But I will say this. I worked for the Mat-Su Borough School District. I worked for the homeschool correspondence program. It was a game changer for me. It was an eye-opener. It was a life changer. Because in that program, what I saw were parents being empowered to make decisions for their own kids. So when I was working that program, I was getting near a retirement. I had a very ill mother back east, and I wanted to spend time with her. So I was going to retire. And when I was on the verge of doing that, I had people come to me and ask me to run for the school board. And they said to me, Mike, here's the deal. We have over 3,000 children in the borough boundaries that should be going to our school district that don't want to or can't or for whatever reason aren't. How can we expand our programs? How can we become more inclusive other than just the bricks and mortar school? How can we expand the homeschool correspondence program? How can we expand charter schools? How can we expand opportunities for parents to be able to show parents and show kids that, hey, this is a great school district. Why don't you become part of it? So I ran for the board. I was elected. After year one, I was voted in by the members to be president of the school board. And we worked very closely and very diligent with our administration. And basically the bottom line is this. We said we have to get away from the thinking that this is all about a system. If you listen to the discussions last year about SGR9, what you heard were systems, things, schools, systems, public school, etc. And lost in that conversation were discussions about individual living human beings. So one of my goals was to get every one of those 3,000 kids to say to themselves, their parents, say, you know what? Mat-Su School District is so irresistible because of the multitude of programs they have that we're going to want to go there. And so that was the idea with the innovation, and that continues today with Mat-Su, is you want to be as innovative as possible. You want to meet the needs of your customers as much as possible. You want to help educate kids to the highest degree as much as possible. It can't just be done in a neighborhood school. Will the neighborhood schools be the mainstay of education in the state of Alaska for some time? Absolutely. Should they be supported? Absolutely. But that doesn't mean it's an if or, an only but, or this or that. We can have a large tent under public education in which we have public-private partnerships, homeschooling, independent learning online using technology. I mean, we're only limited by our imagination and our creativity and our ability to get beyond the systems that we have in place now.
Okay. And while it wasn't part of the text of SJR9 or HJR1, a lot of people were referring to the constitutional amendment that you carried in the Senate, Representative Keller carried in the House, as being a gateway for school vouchers.
Right.
And, I mean, is that how you would characterize that?
I would say this. I would say that SJR9 was enabling language for a multitude of programs to be later developed by the legislature.
Okay. Would that include vouchers?
It could. It could include vouchers. And let me just follow up on that.
Sure.
So one of the arguments made against SJR 9 is that it would spiral out of control. I mean, I heard everything from madrasas to, somebody even said a crusader school. I mean, we're talking stuff that's 1,300 years in the past. But anyway, all kinds of bizarre stuff would occur. Well, if you do the research, if you get beyond the sound bites, if you get beyond the hysteria, if you do the research, there's approximately 26, 27 states in the country with 47 programs. All of those programs are extremely self-contained and targeted. Many of those programs are targeted for special ed kids. Many of those programs are targeted for low-performing kids. Many of those programs are targeted for low-income kids. I'll give you an example of one that has not spiraled out of control. In Vermont, they have a tuitioning program, and the tuitioning program has been around, some claim, for over 200 years, certainly since the 1870s, but all of, some would say 200 years. And what it is in Vermont, where you have a small community or small village, they elected many, many, many years ago not to invest in building a school. So what they've done for 100 and some years, up to 200 years, is they give money to their children, their families, to allow them to decide where they want to go to school. To this day, that still occurs in many Vermont villages and counties in Vermont. And those kids are able to go to school anywhere they want in the world. Because the focus for those people in Vermont, in those particular communities, is on the education of kids. Not the school, not the bureaucracy, but the education of kids. But that's just one example. Mm. And I'll add one more. Alberta, Canada is considered to be the top English-speaking school system in the world. Just behind Shanghai and Hong Kong is Alberta, Canada. And we looked at Alberta, Canada, and tried to figure out why. On international tests, they score extremely well. Alberta's an oil province, just like Alaska is. Alberta's a northern province, just like Alaska is. So we looked at it. And one thing that Alberta has that we don't is they have multiple deliveries, multiple models of education and how it's delivered. They have private schools. They have French-speaking Catholic schools. They have Anglican schools. They have homeschools. They have charter schools. The gamut goes on and on. And what Alberta does is it allows parents and kids to choose where they want to go to school, because they know if you decide where you want to go to school, you're going to be engaged in the program. You're going to do well.
Okay, and that's through a voucher-type program then?
It's through direct aid to schools. It's through, actually, Alberta, Canada, and we'll never be like that, nor should we to this extent. Canada has no separation of church and state. Hmm. That's our constitution. So they've always had direct funding of French Catholic schools, Anglican English-speaking schools, private schools, etc. I'm not advocating for a removal of the separation of church and state concept, but people need to keep in mind this. Your state constitutions are much more restrictive than our U.S. federal constitution when it comes to school funding and giving parents the opportunity to decide where their kids are going to be going to school and fund it. Our state constitution, I'll be very brief, the language in it would allow us to give the indirect aid to parents and kids to decide where they want to go to school. Two subsequent court proceedings after the Constitutional Convention have narrowed that to mean no direct or indirect or any form or fashion. So it limits the state of Alaska in terms of its tools to be able to reach all kids.
Okay. We've got about 10 minutes left in the show. If you want to join in, you can call 733-1200, send us an email, dj@ktna.org, or leave us a comment on our Facebook page. Here with the last little bit, there's a couple more things I want to touch on. One, and it kind of takes us back to energy, and it was a big topic yesterday, obviously, and that's the Sitna-Watana.
Mm-hmm.
Initially, AEA had said they were going to need about $110 million to finish their studies. The governor asked for 42.7. The legislature gave them 20. And when you and I spoke over the phone during session, it was $10 million right at that point. When it went over to House Finance, $10 million more got added in. With the gas line going at the same time, I mean, where do you see, and the state, you know, looking at its spending, where does the Sitna-Watana fall?
Right.
Because like you said, you ran on a platform of cheap energy.
Right.
AEA says this will give cheap energy.
Mm-hmm.
Where does that stand? Where do you that stand with you today?
Well, I think the concept of the philosophy that was not really stated, but was acted on over the past maybe even decades, at least this past several years, was we were trying to be all things to all people with all projects and all programs. We may be at a point now where we have to make some decisions on what mega projects we can really afford and what's going to return the best dollar to Alaskans. So the question comes down, is it going to be Wantana? If the question comes down to whether it's going to be Wantana or the gas pipeline, you know, there are still folks that want to see studies out of Wantana. There are still folks that want to see whether, in fact, a large dam on the Susitna, north or upriver from Devil's Canyon, can produce cheap energy for 100 years or plus, as they state it could, won't destroy the environment, as some believe it could. There are still many folks that are waiting for those studies to determine whether, in fact, it's worthy of funding. Similar, but not to the extent, because it's a different setup, is the gas pipeline, which we've talked extensively about. But the long story short for Wantana is, we've got to see what these studies say. And these studies, in the end, may say this is not a project that should move forward. To be honest with you, I'm hesitant to kill projects until I see data in front of me. I'm hesitant to move projects totally forward. Again, as we mentioned, the gas pipeline, it's a year-by-year situation where we have off-ramps. If it's not going to work, we can get out of the gas pipeline concept. But in terms of Wantana, I really would like to see the data and the studies. And in the end, if the data and studies show that this is not a project that's good for Alaska, it's not going to happen.
Okay. And, I mean, we've got 8,600 pages, I think, was the number thrown out yesterday at the meeting of initial study reports. And, obviously, I don't plan on reading all 8,600 pages of that. I would doubt that you would as either. So, I mean, who do you rely on at that point to provide information?
We can go back to outfits such as Legislative Budget and Audit, which is an independent outfit for the legislature, divorced of companies, divorced of the administration. And we'll be having people go through these studies.
So third parties.
And our staffs will be going through these studies. But again, it's a multi-billion dollar project. It needs to be good for Alaska and good for Alaskans. And if the studies indicate that that's not the case, it's not going to move forward.
Okay. So we're down to, we got just a few minutes left, and I want to talk a little bit. This is, even though you were elected 2 years ago because of redistricting, you're up for election again this year. In fact, I can see the signs on the back of your truck from
you want one?
No, I'm good. I think that would be frowned upon if we put up a sign property.
I'm kidding.
But up until, right up until the deadline, it didn't look like you were going to have any challenges. You've got two now.
Yes.
One is Neil Lacey, who was also a former, or maybe that's Keller. That's running
that's
against Representative Keller. Sorry,
correct.
My mistake.
Right.
So you've got both a Democrat challenger and an unaffiliated challenger. The unaffiliated is Warren Keough, who used to be on the borough assembly here.
Yes.
And then the Democrat challenger is Mixie Willoya Marks.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Sorry.
That was good.
Just read that name for the first time yesterday. So, I mean, have you, what's your interaction with either of those folks? Do you know them?
I can't recall meeting the lady. I know Warren, and we've had some interactions because I was on the school board when he was on the assembly. Mm-hmm. And you know, I tell you what, a lot of folks in politics that hold elected office, they hope that nobody runs against them. I've never really been of that ilk. I really believe that this is a role that should be temporary. This is a role that politicians should take very seriously, that they're representing the people, and that these challenges, I think, are fantastic for the process. When I like you, at 5 o'clock Monday, I looked and I said, there's nobody running. 2 hours later, it was inputted that there were people running, and my feeling at that point was this is very good for the process. It gives me an opportunity to state what my positions are, state what I've done in the legislature, It gives those folks the same opportunity. And in the end, it comes down to the people to decide who they want down there doing business. So I'm actually looking forward to it.
Okay. And I guess part of that discussion as well is now that the shape of your district has changed significantly.
It's grown.
It's a very big district now, all the way to Valdez. Is that right? Or near Valdez?
Yeah, the way I describe it, it's south of Cantwell, down to Houston, out to Squintna. Actually wraps around now and touches Kinnick Arm beyond Point McKenzie. Then goes Houston along Selden and along the Talkeetna Mountains, just north of Wasilla and Palmer, Hatcher Pass, squeezes out of the Glen Highway, goes all the way to Glen Allen, goes all the way to Valdez, goes north of Delta and Whittier.
In Whittier.
Yes.
Okay.
So if you were to stretch that road system out, you got several hundred miles you've gone.
Yeah, no doubt. And so, I mean, it's that is a bizarre shape. And that was part of the redistricting plan that was initially held up, but now right. has been released. So that's a heck of a lot of ground to cover for your campaign.
Right. We had Palmer, the city of Palmer, last 2 years, and I really enjoyed working with those folks. But I got to tell you, I live on 45 acres up against the mountains, as I mentioned, the Talkeetna Mountains down by Wasilla. We got horses, we got mules, we heat with wood, as I mentioned, we heat with oil. I lived in rural Alaska for close to 20 years, and I enjoy serving folks that live in rural Alaska. And we're going to have a lot on the road system, so I look forward to it.
Okay. And I mean, as we go forward, obviously you still don't have a primary challenger, and you won't, I guess, because the deadline's
Correct.
Passed.
Correct.
So really, I mean, you're looking ahead to November at this point.
Yes.
We don't quite have enough time. There are a number of ballot issues. It's going to be a crowded ballot on November.
It's going to be somebody said a cacophony of all kinds of ballots and voting and people and initiatives. Yes.
We got three initiatives: voting for governor, lieutenant governor, senator.
Congressman,
state senator, state representative.
All your representatives and half of your Senate.
Yeah. So it's going to be a very full election year. We've already been hearing, at least on the U.S. Senate race, there's already a lot of advertisements and a lot of money and a lot of data being sent around.
Yes.
So,
yes.
We'll be following the campaign here at our end, and I'm sure we'll be hearing from you, and as well as your election opponents as time goes on. So we're getting pretty close on time. I can give you just probably about 30 seconds or a minute if you want to give kind of a parting statement.
Yeah, I just I mean, every time I drive, I'm just this isn't a pandering, but every time I drive up the highway on a clear day and you see the mountain, you see the rivers. I mean, there's nowhere else like this on the face of the earth, and Alaska is just a spectacular place. And I've been blessed with to a great degree with this redistricting, because like I've mentioned, I get to come up here and see great people and great scenery. I now get to go to the Glen Highway and the Richardson and see great people and great scenery. And I look forward to working with folks on those issues and solving issues and helping folks move Alaska forward. So I'll be out and about in communities and towns and talking with folks. And Philip, I really appreciate you asking me to come here today, and I look forward to coming back to talk more about issues.
All right, great. You did luck out on getting a very pretty parts of Alaska.
It's fantastic.
So. All right. Well, that is just about all the time we've got for today for Sioux Valley Voice. If you missed part of the show or want to listen again, we'll be re-airing the program at 7 o'clock, or you can listen anytime at ktna.org. My guest today has been Senator Mike Dunleavy. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.